This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling-Biru. Welcome to Pop Culture Confidential. In Billy Wilder's masterpiece, Sunset Boulevard, the ambitious young script reader Betty Schaefer asks the cynical and struggling screenwriter Joe Gillis, "Don't you sometimes hate yourself?" "Constantly," Joe replies. Gillis is one of the great writers and crisis characters in film history, and there are many. This character has been a constant in Hollywood, and this year is no exception. On the show today, we're going to talk about what makes the writer in crisis so fascinating, 2023's many interesting iterations, and our top 10 favorites historically. And joining me to do this, well, he's really one of the greats in film criticism and analysis, with such a passion for cinema. I'm a longtime listener of his podcast, The Big Picture, which he co-hosts with Amanda Dobbins, and he is the head of content at The Ringer. Sean Fennessy, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Christina. A very enthusiastic and kind introduction, which I really, really appreciate.
Well, it's all true.
I don't know about that, but I am also kind of a lapsed writer, so I look forward to exploring this with you.
Does the writer in crisis resonate with you then on a personal level?
Is there a writer who is not in crisis, I think, is a more appropriate question.
I'm married to a screenwriter in constant crisis, so we might not get into that, but I can tell you stories.
Yeah, I feel like it's definitional to the character, like it's self-doubt, confusion, anxiety, the sense that you're not achieving what you need to, that you need to get back to work, that what you've done isn't good enough. I feel like these are core aspects of the person. And so also films being such a writer-driven medium, it feels not surprising that you see so many stories like this in the space.
Right. That's the premise of today's talk. There's so many writers in general, but we're going for this subcategory, the writer in crisis, because this year has so many. It started with Julia Louis-Dreyfus' movie, You Hurt My Feelings, about a writer who overhears her husband saying he does not like her latest work. Andrew Hayes, All of Us Strangers, the screenwriter looking back at his parents. Justin Triet's Anatomy of a Fall, the marriage between two writers and a courtroom drama. And there's more. Celine Sion's Past Lives is about two playwrights. Cord Jefferson's American Fiction. There's even documentaries like The Pigeon Tunnel about Jean Le Carré, betrayal and writing. Is there a reason, Sean, you think that in the zeitgeist that these writer characters and themes are so big now?
I have a thesis. I don't know, more of a theory. I don't know if it's provable, but I do think that the writer's crisis was amplified for all people during COVID. And the sense of claustrophobia and the sense of being locked in a room with nowhere to go but your thoughts was something that everyone really understood from 2020 to roughly 2022. And so because of that, these stories are more resonant. And so it's maybe easier for studios, executives, the movie-going public to better understand some of the issues that these characters are going through. I think also almost all of these movies are produced by either independent studios or smaller studios. Like, I don't know if any of these movies, with the exception of The Pigeon Tunnel, which is an Apple movie, are not like mainstream stories. I think there's something notable about that.
And you were talking about that a bit before, but why is the writer such a good vessel? You write what you know. So what else would you say about that?
Well, I feel like writers, our understanding of writers is that they are people who are in command of their own thoughts and are clear communicators. That's not actually always the case in real life, but when you have the power to write beautifully, you understand yourself and you understand what you want to say. That makes for a great movie character, because movie characters have to express themselves. They have to verbalize what is going on in their worlds in most cases. And so I think that It's also like, it's not necessarily the most relatable struggle, because if you're someone who works in, I don't know, if you're a builder, you don't really understand what it's like to be a writer, and writers don't necessarily understand what it's like to be a builder. But I think anybody kind of struggling with an internal issue, with an emotional issue, is inherently relatable. And a writer's job in many ways is to kind of transmogrify their personal issues, their personal understanding of the world into their work. And so they're usually a really good vessel. I do think that some films and stories about writers can be navel-gazing and mm-hmm. can be self-reflective at a loss in some ways. But this year's crop, the movies that you've cited already, are among the best films of the year. So I'm not sure why that is specifically. Maybe it's just chance that great filmmakers happen to take on this topic.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say, because you can definitely relate to not being able to do what you love to do. I remember in Kafka, he said, a non-writing writer is a monster courting insanity. I mean, basically, and that applies to most of us who are, you know, not allowed to do what we want to do. And if you're having writer's block, which so many of these characters often have, that's something very relatable. But yes, I completely agree. They're so great. And these crop of movies feel particularly personal, like Andrew Hayes. How do you feel about All the Strangers?
I like it quite a bit. I have this unfortunate job of talking about the awards race. And so often my brain goes to, like, where does it fit in the calculus of this year's Oscar season, which is like pointless when trying to have a sincere conversation like this. You know, actually, we may have seen it at the same screen.
We did, fact, yeah.
at the Telluride Film Festival. And I thought it was quite beautiful and quite touching. And it's been interesting thinking about it and thinking about where I'm at in my life. You know, I've lost a parent. I'm interested in where Andrew Hay is in as a person and how he's seeing the world. Like, we've watched him use his films, I think, to communicate about how he feels about getting older and what love means, what your relationship to your parents and romantic partners and identity. And in some cases, it's very overt, you know, and in Weekend, it's very clear, like, why that feels like mm-hmm. almost an autobiographical movie. And then in a movie like Lean on Pete, he seems to be using it metaphorically about connection, relationship, friendship, alienation. This movie felt like a kind of an amalgam of everything he had done to that point and kind of a culmination. Some of it, I think, works beautifully. I was very, very touched by the portrayal of his relationship to his parents, the Andrew Scott character. But I think in an effort to not illuminate or not elucidate the specifics of the world that he made, he left a lot of gray area that, for some people, I think is going to work magnificently. For me, at times, I tripped on it. It's not a heavy criticism of the movie, but I think because I'm also a really big admirer of genre films, I tend to get a little bit of genre logic brain going when you introduce the concept of a ghost story. And I didn't always understand where he was going. I don't think of this movie, though, Christina, as a movie about a writer, even though you're 100% right that it is. It's a movie about a screenwriter. And that actually maybe helps me frame it a little bit better, because maybe this is a person who is thinking about his emotional experiences through the lens of having to craft a genre story to make it make sense, which is so fascinating. What did you think of it? I don't know if we discussed it after we saw it.
Oh, I was gutted. It completely got me. And I also lost a parent. It spoke to me so much about, I actually was not only thinking about the my mother that I lost and what I should have said and didn't say and what, you know, everything that was between us. I was also thinking of should I be saying to my children? What am I not saying? Yeah. What am I not doing? So it just got me on so many levels. And I thought the love story was amazing. And I was really involved in the fact that not knowing what's real, what's not real. And I sort of made that my own thing with my emotions, thinking of my own family. So that really worked for me. So it was great. I thought it was one of the best of the year, and the performances were really good as well. And the music, it's sort of my era.
There's one scene in a club that is particularly incredible.
God. Yeah. But what do you make? I was going to say, what you made of the Andrew Scott character in terms of our premise here? How is he? What's his writer's crisis about?
Yeah, I think being completely unresolved in the way he is connected and communicated with the people in his life, and what trying to understand whether or not that was his fault or someone else's fault, I think is an interesting way of seeing it. And I had the exact same experience thinking about my mom, who I also lost, and what I did say and didn't say, and when I was there and wasn't there, and why that was the case, and maybe what she did or said to me that I wonder if she would take back. And that's a very profound thing to kind of scrape in a person's feelings when you're watching a movie. I mean, most movies, you know, I live for movies and I watch them all day, every day, but very few can kind of identify those feelings. So as far as the writer, I think because he's a person who has to understand his character's motivations and backstory and world and how he wants to present it to an audience, there's something kind of ritualistic, psychologically demanding that he's doing in the film, where he's kind of returning to these figures from his past to better understand them, to relive, to reconnect. Whether or not he gets catharsis or clarity is an interesting question.
Yes,
of the film.
That's interesting.
I don't know. I don't know if he does. I'd probably like to ask Andrew Hay about that too. I don't know. What do you think about that?
I'm very unsure about that too. But one thing that I really felt is that how difficult it is, and seeing my husband as well as a writer, when you really are writing about yourself, not just metaphorically, not just using little pieces in another story, but like really having to challenge, you know, your own and you know, building the characters of your parents in the way that he does. And that alone is a crisis.
It is. I think it's an interesting pairing with his movie 45 Years too, you know, which is about a long relationship and kind of some untold secrets in the relationship and kind of what we don't say to the people that we love. You know, that's most movies about writers, like I said earlier, are very verbal. All of Us Strangers is a very quiet, very unspoken kind of movie. Even in the kind of confrontational moments, it isn't always about getting it all out there. In particular, there's a conversation that he has with Claire Foy's character, who plays the younger version of his mother. And I don't feel like they actually even said everything that they needed to say. You know, at a certain point, like the Claire Foy character she has to be who she is. You know, it's not a completely imaginary world where everyone gets to close all the loops on our life, which I think is just was an interesting choice by him. I also don't know anything about the source material. I think it's based on a novel.
Yeah.
And how much liberty he took with the story. But I completely agree. It feels like he is writing about his life.
Talking about relationships, let's talk about the writers in crisis in a marriage. So in Anatomy of a Fall, for example, where you have a married couple at the core, the husband dies and she's accused. And then basically it's a court drama. And there is a fight at the center between these two writers. They're both writers. That is pretty much, I was at the edge of my seat and like wanted to put a pillow on my face. It's just a really, really realistic and horrible fight, but also very much about writing, about one not being able to write, one having much more success, about having writer's block. What do you make of like the married writer couples?
Well, I'm glad you pointed out that scene. That might be the scene of the year.
Oh my God.
That is an eerily upsetting scene and very resonant if you've ever been in a long-term relationship. Forget about if you're a writer, just any relationship.
Anybody.
It nails an aspect of the marital fight that is really profound.
What you should have done for me, what things I have done for you. Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, every 5 to 10 years, my wife and I, with whom I've been for a long time, almost 25 years, we've been together. We dated in high school, my wife. I mean, we know each other inside and out. And I love my wife, of course. But every 5 to 10 years, you have a fight where you're like, this is the war. This is the things that we have not said to each other, and we are saying them. And that fight is an even more extreme version of that disagreement that people will have in their relationships. It's interesting that they're both writers, because it is the prime example of what I'm talking about, which is two razor sharp, intelligent people who know exactly how to communicate what they think about the world. They are tremendously literate and articulate about their feelings, and every word is a dagger. I love that sequence so much in that movie, even though I think it is a little bit of a cheap construct in the building of the movie. You know, it's
there's a reason it's there.
yeah. But the fact that we get to see it and it is evoked so clearly is so wonderful. I am not married to a writer, but being in the media, I have so many of my friends are couples that are writers or podcasters nowadays or what have you. Like they have similar careers. My wife was a is a math whiz and graduated from Johns Hopkins with a mathematical sciences degree. She is like 180 degrees from me in so many ways. Yeah, she is a genius for sure, but also in a completely different kind of intelligence than I have or most of my friends have. So we don't have that kind of sparring. But I think that I have seen it quite a bit in my social circles, because there's like a competitiveness, you know, that I think is under the surface. And the movie does a really nice job of clarifying when one person kind of has the upper hand or has had more success. I don't know. I mean, you're in a circumstance like that. Like, what do you make of
that? We have, but it also makes for very interesting discussions on the other side that I wouldn't give up for the world, that, you know, the intellectual discussions we can have and the fights we can have about some cultural property, but that just becomes so interesting and opens my mind so much. But oh my God, we know where to stick that dagger. But you know, it's interesting, Shauna, when I was putting this together, I was thinking married writer couples on film are often really horrible. It's like Bernard and Joan Berkman in The Squid and the Whale. Like Joan Castleman and The Wife. Remember Shirley, the writer, the novelist, the horror story.
Shirley Jackson.
I mean, that marriage is also, there's something about writers being married in film that, you know, they're really capitalizing on what you're talking about.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, can we just say that like writers for the most part are very unhappy people?
Yes.
Like, I think that's a significant factor. And I don't totally know why that is. Like I said, I was a writer for a very long time and I have not really been doing it much at all in the last 3 or 4 years. And I sorely miss it, but I don't miss the angst of doing it. And you hear all the time, like, you know, writer's least favorite part of writing is the writing, you know, or most like they don't actually like the act of the writing. Maybe they like the editing, maybe like the moment it's published, maybe they like the idea conception, but the physical act of doing it causes such pain. And I do think that tends to bleed over into
and narcissism. Yeah.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
That's when two of them together.
no question. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about some other movies where for which this is the case. And a lot of times too, The Squid and the Whale is a great example too, because that's very similar to Anatomy of a Fall, where it feels as though one person has the upper hand and another person clearly does not. And, or maybe there has been a shift in power over time, or someone has never been able to seize the power that they feel they deserve in their relationship. I don't know. I honestly thank my lucky stars I'm not married to a writer or a person in the media. I've said this, I mean, my wife and I have talked about this all the time, because frequently we will go out to dinner, you know, group dinner with a bunch of friends, and it's like seven jerks who just go to screenings all week and want to talk about movies. And my wife, who's a very engaged cultural consumer, but who's like, you guys just care about this way too much. Like, your desire to bicker over these things is absurd.
Oh, so, I feel guilty.
Well, no, I mean, it's honestly like we choose the life we want in many ways. And she chose to be around me and all of these people. So it is interesting, though, because I do think that narcissism pervades anybody who chooses to live this way.
Well, we're going to get into some other ones. I just want to talk about one of the new ones, which I haven't seen yet. But I'm hearing so much about American Fiction, thinking what is sort of the premise of the writer in that one?
Fascinating. I mean, how much do you want me to spoil for you? I don't want to ruin this wonderful movie for you.
I'm fine with spoilers, but if you can sort of, for the listeners, keep it on balance.
Sure. In the film, Jeffrey Wright plays a college professor and novelist who is at, you know, who has reached middle age, whose mother is getting older, whose siblings are getting older, they're getting divorced, he's still unmarried. And he's struggling because after publishing a series of novels that have been warmly received, but have not been big hits, and it's been a long time since a genuine success, he's taking a look at the landscape of modern fiction. And he's wondering where he went wrong, particularly when it comes to fiction. He's played by Jeffrey Wright, so he's a black author, but who does not want to be defined by his race as an author. But he sees what a lot of contemporary fiction looks like, and the way that he perceives it is there's a kind of knowing exploitation happening amongst black writers, in which they're speaking to a demographic that he feels is beneath him, or that is kind of like a low cultural reach. And he's embittered by this, and while all these things are happening with his family, he makes this bold choice to kind of parody the world that he has observed has become successful and use some of those tools to write a book that he thinks, quote unquote, will sell, but is reprehensible And he's done it just out of like frustration. And one of the things I love about this movie, and I haven't talked to the writer director of the movie, but I think I will on my show. But Cord Jefferson, there's so much consumption of alcohol in this movie. And Jeffrey Wright's character almost always has a drink in his hand. And people don't talk about it, but I certainly remember in my writing days, I drank all the time. I drank so much less now that I don't write. And on a jag one night where he's poured himself a couple of whiskeys, he writes this book. And the way that the writing of the book is rendered in the movie is something I've never seen before. It's quite brilliant. And then lo and behold, the book itself, his agent reads it and finds that it's actually quite interesting. He thinks there's a market for it, and it becomes a hot property. And I won't really spoil anything else from there, but you know, this book that he's written is something that he despises, you know, that he doesn't feel is worthy, that he is trying to locate what's wrong with our culture by doing something that he feels is easy. And the fact that it has become a success makes him hate himself even more and makes him hate our culture and our world even more.
Fascinating, and so he's really, writer in crisis.
He's this embittered, like frustrated person who's thinking about himself and where he comes from and what he's gotten from his parents and what he's gotten from his understanding of his place in the world. Such a rich movie. And also it's a big idea movie, but it's really funny, really funny. And it is a like kind of the genuine article about what you're talking about. Like it is entirely focused on the act of writing, what people want from writing and what they want from the reading experience, and how commercialization collides with art. And it's a very special movie. I liked it quite a bit.
Cannot wait.
It's also the movie I didn't see it coming, I guess. And maybe if you hear me talk about it right now, I'm kind of ruining what's coming for you in some ways, which I feel bad about. But it's eerie that you located this idea in a year where this may become the signature film from this idea.
I can't wait. Let's get into talking some of our historically favorite writers in crisis. I don't know what yours are. I'm sure we'll have a few of the same, but why don't you start?
Well, I think it would be, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention The Shining, Stephen King adaptation by Stanley Kubrick, about a writer who may or may not be a horrendous person, but obviously a book written by a person in crisis, and Stephen King, who has been at war with writer's block, with paranoia, with addiction in some ways, with a sense of confusion about how to be a person in a family. And it's kind of the signature portrayal of writer's paranoia.
It's the alpha of this category. I mean, all very, work very and no so. Play makes Jack the dull boy. I mean, everyone knows that and knows that he's a writer.
So I want to ask you about this in particular. Do you think that the trigger for everything that Jack Torrance kind of undergoes in the movie is primarily motivated by his frustrations creatively, or is it more a movie about an unexplored trauma that he experienced, or is it actually just a ghost movie about a haunted hotel that then leads him to be like, when you read the movie, how do you read it?
Well, what makes it so good is it's all of the above. But for me, it's absolutely mostly the writer's crisis, because it's Stephen King, because he has done this so often. He has writers in so many of his stories and has come back to this, and it's a metaphor for so much of the horror he has written. And the way Jack Nicholson plays it, there again, you have the alcohol, the frustration. No, so for me, it absolutely, that's the key thing. But I think you can certainly think it's a fantastic movie feeling it's just a ghost story and he's possessed by this hotel.
Yeah, I feel like writers very easily identify what the issue is in the movie. Most people don't think of it as a movie about a writer, I don't think. Even though for our purposes, it's like you say, it's kind of a key movie. What about you? What's one you like?
I'm going to go with the writers in Royal Tenenbaums. Cash and Margot Tenenbaum, which I love. I love that movie.
Me too.
I think that Eli Cash, like in the movie you were talking about, strikes it big with his second novel. I guess he's sort of a Cormac McCarthy type, but he's also a horrible drug addict and he really wants to be part of the Tenenbaum family. He's sort of like Richie in The Bear, which is one of my favorite all-time characters. I think I am that one who sort of didn't really have that nuclear family growing up, so Mowgli's looking for other families.
And
on then, of course, Margot Tenenbaum, played so brilliantly by Gwyneth Paltrow, who's this award-winning playwright with severe writer's block, who's adopted and really mysterious and constantly smoking and missing a finger. And I just think those are within this family and within the relationship, those are great.
I was curious, what'd you make of Asteroid City? Because that's also very much a movie about a writer and a playwright and the construction of the story. And that's like, it's in a way, the Edward Norton character is a kind of writer in crisis as well.
Yes, I didn't even think about this for this list. That's a great example. I mean, I really like that movie. I know that people are very split on it, but I'm kind of a Wes Anderson head, so it works for me. I thought it was quite magical, and I actually thought it was one of his most sentimental movies in a while, which really got me. That's interesting. Absolutely. It's the same. That's also, I guess, Wes Anderson also is playing with these themes.
Yeah, I have an example for my next movie that is also related to a movie that is coming out this year. This theme runs really deep this year.
It really does.
A movie that I really like, we did a rewatchables episode about this movie earlier this year, is Alexander Payne's Sideways,
Which
is about a kind of frustrated novelist who ventures out on a bachelor party weekend with his best friend before he's about to be married. The writer, played by Paul Giamatti, also stars in a movie this year, The Holdovers, written and directed by Alexander Payne. The Holdovers has not been pitched as a movie about a writer or a frustrated writer, but it very much is. It's very much about, it's very much in conversation with Sideways in so many ways. And it's their first time working together again, Payne and Giamatti.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And Giamatti's character in The Holdovers as well kind of aspires to be a great academic writer and has had a brilliant education.
He doesn't get to the next level. Yeah.
He can't do it. He can't write it. And I mean, I've never written a book, and anybody you talk to who's written a book is like, Jesus, the first one, holy shit, it is so hard.
It's like having
so much work.
Three babies.
Yes. Everyone says that. And perhaps that has warned me off of it in some ways, but I think that Sideways obviously is very much the same, where it is a writer who has been slaving over something. And when you hear Giamatti's character in Sideways talk about his book or tell Virginia Madsen about it, it sounds absolutely awful. You know, it sounds deeply convoluted and kind of phantasmagoric and ridiculous and confused. And it's because it's someone who's kind of been mulling over something for too long and hasn't been able to pull himself outside of it. And sometimes you can get too inside of your work. Mm-hmm. And I really like that portrayal. And I love these movies being paired together too, because, you know, Payne, I think, is a little bit divisive, but there is a kind of sourness in his writing that if you find an actor who's capable of communicating it, it can be poetic, it can be musical. And Giamatti is like, he and Reese Witherspoon are the two absolute best at reading his dialogue, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. So my next one is a bit meta. It's Heartburn.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is about, in the movie, she's a writer, Rachel, and she's married to this political columnist, but it is Nora Ephron, the writer, writing about her divorce from Carl Bernstein in this incredible book and movie. The movie stars Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson, and very much in the vein of what we were talking about before, married writers.
Yeah, I love this movie. I love this similar to Anatomy of a Fall, yeah. Like, yeah, in terms of the just like pure rage that sometimes,
and the intellectual rage.
yeah, just like boiling over. Why do you think Mike Nichols connected with this movie?
Oh, I'm sure that he had these fights, and he was fascinated by that verbiage that comes out of something to smart people. So I think, I mean, it's absolutely perfect for him.
Yeah, I like this one a lot too. You want me to do another one?
Yes, go ahead. That was 9. We're not really doing them in any order, but
I don't have quite 10, but I have close.
Oh, good.
How about Barton Fink?
Oh, that's one of mine. Let's talk about that one.
That's great. Obviously, one of the Coen brothers' early masterpieces, another movie about a screenwriter, I guess technically a playwright, attempting to become a screenwriter, leaving the safety of Broadway and the success of Broadway to come to Hollywood to learn how to become a Hollywood screenwriter and maybe write a wrestling picture for Wallace Beery. Another movie about paranoia, about the inability to get across what you want to say, about being understood, about entering the world of commerce. It's always funny. You know, the Coen brothers, I don't know if they've ever actually talked about the commercial expectation of movies. I don't really feel like they care. No,
they don't.
And yet this movie is kind of about that. Mm. It is about being in the inside of the business of writing. And obviously, like, the angst and the repression and all the other things that come to the surface. I love the John Mahoney portrayal of the Faulkner-esque character in this movie. And Faulkner, who also kind of near the end of his career came to Hollywood and started taking screenwriting gigs in order to, I guess, just make some money and save his life as he died slowly of alcoholism. But none of these movies are very happy, are they?
No, they're not.
It's not a very happy movie.
But one thing that's great about Barton Fink, too, is that here you really get the visualization of all these distractions that the writer feels or thinks that he feels, be it like a mosquito or all these external factors that are like a struggle just to be able to start writing, and the irritation that either it's in his head or it's actually real.
Yeah, I love that. So that's a brilliant movie. I can't imagine. I mean, have people listening to your show not seen Barton Fink? I
assume they've seen Barton Fink. They must have seen Barton Fink.
Do you think they've seen Ace in the Hole?
Well, I certainly have. I'm sure many have.
Yeah, I feel like it's a little bit lost. Mm-hmm. It's kind of second tier Billy Wilder at this point.
It's actually one of my screenwriter husband's absolute favorites.
That's interesting. Yeah. I think another movie that really explores like the venality and selfishness of writers and what they will do to get what they need to finish what they need to do. Kirk Douglas movie about a newspaper journalist who finds a man trapped in a mine and kind of exploits the man who's trapped and all the people in a town, but is a brilliant movie. And I think, do you ever feel selfish as a creative person? Like, do you feel like you're putting yourself over everyone else around you?
Oh, of course. Don't you?
I mean, and yes, it's probably
the guilt. I mean, guilt is part of every day. Being a mother and everything else, but absolutely being a creative person on top of it.
Yeah. Having a kid totally raises the stakes on this too. Cause you're just like, anything I'm doing about my stuff is at the expense of my child. Mm-hmm. And that is just a huge error. It's a fascinating thing. Anyway, Ace in the Hole is a great movie.
Yeah. And we're going to get back to Billy Wilder, of course, because he's probably the best at this game. But I want to do another Stephen King while we're here. And that's Paul Sheldon, James Caan in Misery. I mean, talk about maybe the writer in most physical crisis of all of the ones we've talked about. He's the author of a beloved kind of a Victorian set of novels who gets in an accident and is saved by a fan who turns out to be a psychopath. And Kathy Bates, who chains him up in another one of the biggest anxieties of Stephen King's writers.
A real careful what you wish for movie, you know. Yes. the success you seek is not exactly, does not manifest in the ways that you hope. Really, I mean, that's a delicious movie. It's really, really a lot of fun. What about adaptation?
Yes, that's my number 2, actually. So,
oh, exciting. The Charlie Kaufman scripted, Spike Jonze directed. I guess adaptation of the Susan Orlean nonfiction book, The Orchid Thief, which is actually much more about Charlie Kaufman and his inability to adapt the film The Orchid Thief, so much so that he creates a character out of both himself and a twin that does not exist, both of whom are played by Nick Cage. And another movie about like the amazing evocation of the inability to write.
No, this is an absolute, I think this one probably has the most amount of self-loathing of all of the writers that we've talked about. It just almost makes me cringe thinking about it.
I have the problem that I think is very common amongst writers, which is that I think, and I'm happy to be told that I'm wrong, but I think that I have quote unquote talent. And I also think I'm a terrible writer. I like when I read what I've written, it could have been from 30 years ago. It could have been from 2 years ago. I think it is dreadful. And I'm the problem with it is, and I sense this in Charlie Kaufman, who is of course a genius, that you know it's that you know what you want to do, you know what you want to say, you know what you're trying to communicate, and you just can't manifest it. You just don't have the power to manifest it. And I wouldn't even describe myself as completely self-loathing, but in this act, I'm like, why do I suck so much? Like I can't get past that. It's a very challenging thing.
But do you think that if Charlie Kaufman or any of these writers, if they didn't have, or you didn't have, at least a minimum of self-loathing, that it actually would be good?
I don't know. I think about this with novelists.
See, this is the narcissism. I think I have to get nervous. Oh my God, I'm going to be interviewing Sean Fennessy. I've been doing this for years and years and years, but I'm so nervous. And I think if I'm not nervous, it'll, but I mean, you know, I want it to be good. But I think if I would totally lose that, there's also something humble in being that in a way.
Well, I think that makes sense. You were definitely not nervous. When we met this summer, you were so cool, which is why I'm doing the show right now. So,
well, I think friends that you meet in the line in Telluride are something special.
They are. I'm a real believer in that. I genuinely think that is one of the best places in the world, especially if you're post 30, to make friends who are interested in movies. It's amazing. Almost everybody I meet at the festival has the right approach to life. But it's hard to say. I'm interested in writers too, who have had a lot of success and who have seemed to have lost that. Like if you read interviews with John Updike near the end of his life or something, he has a kind of confidence, a self-confidence, it's not arrogant. That's not quite the word. I don't know what the word is to communicate the level of comfort he has with his work that not many people get to. Mm-hmm. You know, most writers, even those who are not crippled by self-doubt, are on a quest to figure something out. And then there is this select few who are like, I know exactly what to do. And once I land on the idea, I pursue. You know, the writers who have like 40 published novels, like who are those people? That they're freaks. That's insane that they can accomplish that.
Well, they're the ones who had like Scandi Noir and that type of sort of just one after another.
Yeah, I don't mean so much like the conveyor belt commercial writer, though. In many ways, like James Patterson, like that guy's going to publish 100 novels before he dies. That's remarkable. So I have respect for that, but it's more like the great literary creatures who also publish 50 novels. Like that is baffling to me, genuinely.
I want to mention Mank, which is of course Herman Mankiewicz, the movie about the real screenwriter and the development of Citizen Kane, the 1941 film by Orson Welles. David Fincher, who I think is a master at these types. I know lots of people, this movie was divisive. I thought it was amazing.
It was my favorite movie of that year, and it's one of my favorite Fincher movies. Yeah.
I thought this was just so precise, and it sort of encapsulated so many incredible artists, not only Fincher, but Welles and Mank and all these people. This is also kind of like Misery, a screenwriter, a writer who's in bed recovering from, I guess he's a car crash, right? It's a broken
car accident. Yep.
He an alcoholic while he's drunkenly trying to write the movie that becomes Citizen Kane.
You know what I love about this movie? I absolutely adore this movie. I'm not confused why it's divisive, but I think it's unfortunate that it's become so divisive because people expect a certain thing. If David Fincher's name were not on it, I wonder if people would think differently about it. But it's a movie about a writer on assignment. This is not a writer pursuing a florid passion project. It is a movie that a director has commissioned to a gifted kind of conveyor belt manufacturer of ideas. And one of the great scenes in the movie is this portrayal of the writer's room that was happening at MGM at the time with writers like Ben Hecht, incredible screenwriting geniuses who have remarkable credits to their name, but who also wrote schlocky, goofy comedies. Yeah. And the sequence where we meet the writers and then the writers go in to pitch a new idea to David O. Selznick, is incredible portrayal of the way that the ease with which these men use tropes to invent stories in real time. You know, it comes so easily to these people at, in this moment. And if you've ever met, like I interviewed David Koepp once, the screenwriter, who's a tremendously successful screenwriter who's worked on Spider-Man, Jurassic Park movies, written for Steven Spielberg. He's one of the most successful screenwriters the last 40 years. One, it was a really interesting interview because he was very unafraid to be like a little snide with me, which I actually kind of enjoy. I like to mix it up a little bit sometimes. And I think his perspective, I think he had listened to the show that I make and was like, you don't understand anything about movies.
Okay.
And I kind of enjoyed that because the truth is I don't, you know, like we don't, like we know, we understand what we have seen, but I think what actually goes into the construction, the execution of movies is very unseen and unknown and very much by design. And a movie like Mank, even though it's set 80 years in the past, attempts to kind of show you the manufacturer style of filmmaking that so often happens in Hollywood. And so I love that aspect of Mank in particular. And also, obviously, just the idea of the origins of Kane and the portrayal of power in America at that time and all the other themes that are so rich. And the idea that Fincher did this as an ode to his dad, who himself was a journalist and writer. I mean, it's a rich and layered movie with a lot of ideas.
Are there less women in Crisis that are in characters of writers in Crisis that are women? There's very few. I had like Catherine Trammell on my list. Remember Basic Instinct? I don't know if you would authorize, if you're okay with that on this. I mean, I don't know if she's in Crisis or if she's crazy or what.
Christina, it's your show. It's, are you okay with it? You know, I think,
well, she makes a power move of not wearing underwear, but I wouldn't say that's particularly, I don't think that's because of a crisis.
She doesn't seem to be in any kind of crisis. No, she seems to be in total control. Her idea of control is upsetting.
Yes.
And murderous. But I do have a female character who fits the bill here. I loved Mia Hansen Loves Bergman Island, which I thought was another film about a screenwriter, a very autobiographical movie about a couple that traveled to is it Faro? How do I pronounce
Water.
It? You're the right person to ask that question. The world that she creates and her visit to this somewhat mythical and inspiring, but also somewhat banal and disappointing. Mm-hmm.
It's not what you think.
Piece of the world. Yeah. And whether or not it can draw out your creativity, I think is an interesting concept. I've never really gone on a writer's retreat or a writer's vacation. I'm much more like I'd like to be in my garage and it'd be 1 o'clock in the morning and I have a whiskey in my hand rather than attempting to orchestrate or manifest.
Yeah, I don't think I creativity. Could do that either.
Yeah, but I know that many people do this. I know that many people go to their second homes or they go on a vacation and attempt to focus on what they need to execute on. So I like that movie quite a bit, and Vicky Krieps is one of my favorite actresses, so I thought I would add that to the list.
That's great. But not as many of female writers, at least that one can think of in this subcategory. What do you make of Woody Allen's, all his characters?
I love his work so much. I thought a bit of Deconstructing Harry. Have you seen that film?
Yes.
Which is really one of the most bitter and mean-spirited of the Woody Allen movies. And is very much about a writer writing through his life and using the people in his life and exploiting. And I think that this is a very funny and strange movie. And I feel like often Woody Allen is hiding some of the rage that he has. But there is a period in the early to mid 90s where he lets it fly a little bit. You know, Husbands and Wives is right. Also a similarly kind of angry movie and embittered kind of a movie. But Deconstructing Harry it's kind of a farcical romp, but has a real acid tone to it. So I think he's an interesting.
He goes from being like neurotic and comical to angry and cynical.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure that his success is a part of that too. And, you know, feeling misunderstood or feeling like he has maybe more right to sit, to be a little bit more angry. And frankly, like as I get older, I get it, you know, I'm starting to understand the generational divides. Yeah. Things are fucked up.
We are the, in that get off our lawn period. And
I know.
Especially if we're writing.
I wouldn't do that. Of course. I mean, as I look
get
at
off
movies,
my
too,
writer's retreat.
I don't know. Do you have a Woody Allen writer? So many of his movies are about writers.
So many. I mean, I was Alvy Singer and all the ones where he actually makes jokes about writing and writers, I think are really funny, but none that I can sort of pick out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought of Midnight in Paris, right? Because isn't Owen Wilson in Midnight in Paris a writer? A lot of his movies, almost all of his movies are about writers. Should I give you another one?
Yes, please.
What about Almost Famous?
Yes. I was thinking about that one. I wasn't sure if how much of a crisis, but of course, you know, getting the article together, it is kind of a crisis, definitely a crisis for his mom.
Yeah. I think his journey is a crisis, a coming of age. And then once the article is published, that is something that is so interesting to me. You know, like most of the writing that I've done in my life is in the service of celebrities and artists. You know, I worked at music magazines and then kind of lifestyle magazines. And I've now been interviewing filmmakers for years and years. And sometimes you hear back from them about what you've done. Sometimes they don't like it very much.
No.
And that's a unique experience. And that is a kind of crisis when you're a writer. Because on the one hand, you want to honestly represent what you feel you saw or what you feel you understood about a person and how it intersects with what they make and who they are creatively. And sometimes you have this urge to protect them because they were nice to you or because you like what they do. And that conflict is so interesting to me. You know, many of my friends are journalists in this mold, and we all kind of came up together at a time in New York and at magazines. And keeping that balance between being honest about what you've observed in a person and who they are and what they are, but also finding a way to kind of celebrate them and cut them some slack in the face of their very strange lives is hard.
Yeah.
It's really difficult to achieve. And Almost Famous is that problem seen through the eyes of a 16-year-old who's incredibly impressionable and who wants to be liked and is a bit of an outcast. And so it's an amazing metaphor, I think, for the experience of going into a new world and wanting to be accepted. So I love that movie.
It was so funny. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Errol Morris for Pigeon Tunnel, and he spent part of my interview so pissed off at David Marquez and his interview that he railed about it in my interview. without having a question about it, just like coming to think of it. So I think also there are creatives who that one thing. It can be hundreds of bad reviews, but there's one writer that wrote something that just gets you so much that you cannot let that one go. And this is
my favorite topic, Christina. This is like my favorite thing. First of all, I also just interviewed Errol Morris, and
he did not bring up David. Oh,
He didn't bring up David. I know David is a friend of mine. And David, of course, like a world-class interviewer.
Oh my God.
One of the greatest interviewers in the world, but also like, you know, enjoyably confrontational as a style. What Errol Morris brought up when we spoke was Richard Brody's review of his film. And he brought it up because I asked him a question that sincerely was inspired by something I read in Richard Brody's review, though I did not cite it. And the minute I asked it,
but it was right
right at the front of his mind. And I find that so interesting. And I love to ask filmmakers or really any creative people, do you read reviews of your own work? Now, Errol Morris himself is a writer and a great thinker about movies. And so, of course, he reads all of his reviews, especially, or at least the reviews of the critics that he likes. But, some people, when asked that question, lie. Some people pretend to lie and then tell you the truth. Some lie and then tell you off mic the truth. And some, the people that I love, you know, I love James Gray. I've had James Gray on The Big Picture many times. And James will tell you, you know, of course I read these things. And they hurt my feelings so deeply. They hurt so much because everybody is working so hard to make something good, bad people and good people. And I try to bring that mentality whenever I'm talking about this stuff, but sometimes you forget. Because you get into the narcissism that we're talking about where you're like, my opinion is all that matters. So it's a fascinating balance. I'm right. Exactly.
Do you have anything else that you wanted to mention?
Since we just talked about a lot of screenwriters, I thought I would cite In a Lonely Place, the Nicholas Ray, Humphrey Bogart film about a mysterious and perhaps murderous screenwriter. Oh, terrific movie. One of the great kind of Hollywood noirs, like literally about Hollywood and what it's like to work there. A nice pairing, I think, with Barton Fink. They're kind of contemporaneous in their setting and similar in their attitudes toward the world, cynical, everything is aflame, don't trust anyone, and features like a very toxic love affair. I really, really love In a Lonely Place. So if people haven't seen it, it's one of the great movies of the 1940s.
Thank you for reminding me. I haven't seen that in years. I think for me, I mentioned it in the intro, but Sunset Boulevard is just the best of the best. The post-mortem narration, the screenwriter dead in the pool, the way it captures his struggle. And also, I mean, he's down on his luck, but he's also incredibly narcissistic, unapologetic character he's hard to love, to put it lightly.
No, he's vainglorious.
Yes.
He's doing everything for himself.
Everything for himself. And then he meets someone. He comes into this world, which he thinks he understands, but he really doesn't. And I just think it's amazing.
I love it too. It's a great movie. And, you know, Wilder, I don't know, this is a dumb thing to say, but is Wilder the great writer director, like the signature writer director of movie history? He might be. He might be.
My son is named Wilder, his middle name.
I love that.
So incredible. If you're asking me the question, is it? Yes.
Yeah, he really is magnificent. Even his characters that are not writers kind of feel like writers. Jack Lemmon in The Apartment kind of feels like a writer. Oh, he's not a writer. He's an office drone. But he has that same kind of neurotic, searching, questing, that desire to be liked, that desire to be understood. You know, there's something in the character of Billy Wilder's characters that is so relatable. He's the GOAT.
He's the GOAT. On that note, Sean, I've kept you for an hour. Thank you so much for talking to
Christine, me. I had so much fun. It was my pleasure. This was great.
I'm so happy. I hope you'll come on again.
Let me know. I mean, this idea is so good too. You really nailed one.
Thank you so much. And of course, all the listeners, you know where to find Sean. And you have the greatest interviews. I saw the list of things you have coming up for the rest of the season. It's all the big movies and all the big interviews. You have Sofia Coppola on this week, which I do as well.
Yeah, I saw that. Kudos to you. She's great, right? Priscilla, wonderful film.
I think it's top tier for me of her. And I'm a
for her.
Fan.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I agree. It's my favorite in a long, long time from her. But yeah, it's just a great time for films. You know, not to sound like an idiot, but every week there's a really interesting movie out. And that has not been true for 3 or 4 years.
It's an incredible.
We're very lucky right now.
Just to mention, we were talking, Sophia, in my interview about where her father used to go to write when he wanted some peace and quiet. Reno and Vegas. Such an Elvis thing to do. That's where he found his. It's because he could order food 24 hours and then just go and play a little bit. And he found that the most peaceful place.
I'll tell you what, I deeply relate to that as I'm a real Vegas lover. Mm-hmm. I'm not an aggressive gambler, but I love to play poker. And what I liked, my version of Vegas is not bachelor parties and debauchery. It is solitude. I am a kind of a Paul Schrader character in Vegas where mm-hmm. I want to play by myself. Eat by myself. I don't want to party. I don't want to hang out. So maybe I should try writing there. That's
and Francis.
Yeah, well, we're about the same in terms of, you know, talent and experience.
Absolutely.
And yeah, we're very similar.
Sean, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Christina.
We are gathered here today to give you permission to plan the wedding that you want.
I'm Jessica Bishop.
And I'm Sari Wienerman.
And we're the hosts of the Bouquet Toss podcast.
Today's couples have to juggle so many things, from family expectations to outdated traditions and what's currently trending.
So to make it easier, we're going deep to figure out why we do weddings the way that we do, so you can decide what to keep and what to toss from your wedding day plans.
You are cordially invited to subscribe to the Bouquet Toss wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcast.com.
By the power vested in us, we pronounce you free to plan your day your way.